This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health, and we begin with a health hazard that has reached epidemic proportions. According to the World Health Organization, over a billion people globally are obese, and that significantly increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, stroke, to name the biggest risks. And there's a great deal of worrying about measles, even though there are still just a few cases here. So how dangerous is this and why? And there's something I've never heard of before that has already killed a few people in Europe, parrot fever, also called psittacosis. And if you have questions or comments, the number's 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Malcolm Moore, former head of the BC Cancer Agency and a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Centre. And Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto and a general internist at Unity Health Toronto. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Libby.
Hey, Libby. Good to have you back.
Thank you. So, was anybody surprised by this number of a billion worldwide people who are obese? I guess no one was surprised.
Unfortunately, not surprised. Isn't that a sad statement?
Uh-huh. What is your take on it, though? It seems to me that the numbers have exploded in the last, 30, 40 years. Very quickly.
Yeah, maybe I can start, Libby. Yeah. I'll say I actually, a lot of my time in graduate school and in the early part of my career was spent studying obesity. And the rise is really shocking to see what has happened over the last 30 to 40 years. And it essentially has become a plague that has affected every high-income society in the world. And increasingly, we're seeing low-income parts of the world, places in Africa and India that historically had problems with famine, they now have incredible rising rates of obesity and overweight. I think what you are seeing here, and I should add that a lot of what we do in medical care is a downstream effect of obesity. So everything from arthritis to cancer to heart disease to diabetes, obesity and overweight have an important role in causing these things to develop. And there has never been an effective mechanism that can scale across a broad range of the population to reduce the rates. And if you look at Canada, for example, well upwards of 50% of all adults in the country are either overweight or obese at this point. And so this is, I think, we've talked about this a lot on the show. The reason why a medication like Ozempic and that family of medications, the GLP medications, the reason why they've drawn such attention is that they are really, at an individual level, the only therapy we've ever seen that can have a dramatic effect on weight. And we're talking about people losing 15 to 20% of their weight. So for a typical Canadian adult, that would be starting at 70 to 80 kilograms and losing, something like 15 to 20 kilograms of weight. It's an enormous effect. And we're already seeing the downstream benefits on things like cardiovascular rates, some cancers, et cetera. So, obesity is a massive problem. This report reinforces, I think, what we know. And now we have this class of medications that I think we've talked about a lot, which may be the first effective way of dealing with it.
Dr. Naiman, a couple of things. So I remember reading a bunch of very interesting food books that were trying to say that basically it was the fault of processed food and that they were deliberately made to be addictive. Do you buy that? with salt and fat?
I buy it a little bit. You know, processed foods are usually very high in fat or sugar, and people crave these foods. You know, it's the same thing that, why does everybody crave Coke? Because there's a magic recipe that the company won't release, that it has the right amount of sugar and sweetness and everything else, and so that people crave it. So for sure, there's a link between, you know, if you're depressed, that you're going to go and crave carbs because it's going to release serotonin in your brain, or it's going to increase your dopamine and you're going to feel better, and then you're going to want another hit of it. And then it just becomes this behavioral pattern that is replaced. The same thing as what happens with cigarette smoking. So I think companies probably do have an incentive to make their foods taste really good. And then, but this has been, the rates of obesity have been increasing, and as countries become more industrialized and more westernized, they usually adopt a Western lifestyle in terms of food. So they go away from eating traditional foods, and at the same time, they're in careers or professions where they're not as active as before. And then children, they're spending more and more time on their devices and less time outside. So I think shows exactly that's what's happening here. And, you know, food costs are very high, and generally healthy food costs more than cheaper food. So people are often drawn to eating low quality, cheaper food, and that leads to obesity.
Dr. Moore, also the role of exercise, one of the, so people are obese, it's said, because they are too sedentary, don't do enough exercise. However, on the flip side of things, it's been shown that if you want to lose weight, really exercise is not going to make you lose weight, even though it's very good for you.
Yeah, so, you know, whenever you read these articles, you have to look at what they mean by their definitions. And just as an example, you know, we talked some months ago about this issue that they define problem drinking as anyone who drank more than two drinks a week, which basically means that 80% of the population has a problem with problem drinking. So I did look at this article and said, what was their definition of obesity? And obesity is significantly overweight. So there's actually a calculation they use. So for a person like myself who's 6 feet tall, to be designated as obese, I would have to be over 230 pounds, which is 50 pounds more than I am. So when we're talking about obesity in this survey, we're talking about people who are 40 to 60 or more pounds over their natural body weight. So this is people who are significantly obese. And, you know, exercise and activity is important, but in order to reduce your weight by those sorts of amounts, setting aside the Ozempic issue for a minute, because I'm sure that Novo Nordisk is kind of rubbing their hands about how many potential clients they have, you know, you're going to have to change and reduce your eating habits. You know, calories in, you have to reduce the number of calories in. And it's just both quantity and, as we've alluded to, quality of food that's going to do that.
Dr. Razak, one of the things that a lot of people have found, even if they have this major weight loss, it comes back. And part of the reason it comes back, apparently, I'm given to understand, is because your body goes into starvation mode and it wants that weight back.
Yeah, it does come back. But what I would say is that, and look, a lot of my career was focused on preventative medicine, and I think I would have been one of the least likely people to say a medication approach to managing obesity is a solution. The problem is that the sustainability of weight loss, as you've said, is very, very difficult. Even if you lose weight, your body has adaptive strategies to start to reduce the caloric burn per day, the amount of heat loss. There's all kinds of adaptive strategies to start to kick in. What is remarkable, and again, I don't own pharmaceutical shares and I have no endorsement of any specific medication, but what is remarkable about these agents is that the weight loss is sustained as far as we know, and they've started to trace people out quite long now after the initiation of the medication. as long as the medication continues to be used. So you run into this, I would say, frankly, kind of nightmare scenario where, you know, as Malcolm said, 50% of the population is really significantly overweight. We're not talking about 5 or 10 pounds here. And then we're talking about a medication that would have to be used, an injectable medication that would have to be used for life, essentially, to keep those weights down. And, you know, we've never had a situation in society where we've run into a situation like this, where we have something that is this common, where there is now a very effective therapy, but it is invasive. It is remarkably expensive. So what do you do? And I would feel a lot better about this conversation if there was reasonable evidence that some other strategy was sustainable, that you could really change the way that people eat or exercise in a way that results in significant weight loss, which is sustained. But people have spent billions of dollars across the world doing studies trying to establish those approaches to be effective, and it has never been shown to be effective. This is the problem.
And the question is why, you know, just as an aside, I had a week's holiday, and it was at one of these all-inclusive places where you can eat and drink all day long if you want to. And a huge percentage of the people there were obese.
And I'll just add briefly, you know, that the way that our food production system has changed globally, for example, let's use refined sugars as an example. In order for you to get an entire day's calories, the calorie demand for a typical adult from refined sugars would only cost a few pennies on the global market in terms of the cost of these sugars. Now, I'm not saying that people will eat a pound of sugar a day. My point is that the production of certain kinds of high calorie food has become so cheap and so readily available that the mechanism to prevent people from consuming them is very, very difficult to have, you know, sustained at a society level. Again, we're not talking about 1% of the population. We're talking about more than 50% of the population. So how do you do it practically?
Dr. Naiman, do you have patients who have maybe successfully lost a large amount of weight but then gone on to gain it back?
Yes, so it's sort of the common experience that will happen to people is that you'll lose a significant amount of weight. And up until the Ozempic era, it was really through changing their lifestyle, and a lot of it is focused on the foods that you eat and the quantity and the quality of the food. And then as your body adapts and as you've lost the weight, you've lost your muscle mass, that people start to regain the weight. And then the goal becomes having people understand that there is going to be some weight regain that will happen, but we just don't want you to get back to the level where you were at when we started, and that there is a benefit. Ozempic has completely changed the approach that's taken to weight loss. And I would say that this is that recently in February, the government has changed how when we prescribe Ozempic to people over the age of 65 or who are on OW and have coverage through the government, is that you now have to put a code, and that code is restricted to people who have diabetes. And so if we're looking at this in terms of what are the risks of having obesity in terms of cardiovascular disease, stroke, dementia, all of these other downstream effects that are the result of obesity, the government has now restricted people who did have access to, will no longer have access to this medication, and this medication is very expensive.
Yeah, that's so, why, obviously.
Well, but it's terrible because then in the end, it's going to cost the system even more money. So it becomes very interesting as to why the government has decided to implement this change, because prior to that, a patient could get this medication and it would not require a code that indicated that they had diabetes.
Hmm. That's interesting. I want to take a call from Bernadette, who wants to tell her overweight story. Hello, Bernadette. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I was 200 pounds heavier, and I've lost all that weight on my own volition over about 15 or 20 years. And my story was that when I worked, every promotion caused me to gain 30 or 40 pounds. And, you know, I got right up there, and, you know, I started to go to some of the fat doctors in Toronto and, you know, lost a bit of weight with them, but I put that weight back on. And I spent lots of money, and I, you know, decided that I've got to take this into my own hands, that I'm not going to spend one more penny on weight loss. I'm going to do it on my own. And so I did. And the other thing that I realized is that I went up in steps. Like I put a chunk of weight on and then I stabilized at that weight. And then I put another chunk up and then I stabilized. So I went up in steps. So I had to come down in steps. So I would lose a chunk of weight and then I would stabilize at that weight. And then a few months later, lose another chunk of weight and then stabilize that weight. So I went down in steps and that worked for me.
And how long have you been able to keep all that weight off?
You know, it's been 10 years I've kept it off.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Good for you.
You can do it. And I think, you know, really being mindful of the carbs is critical because the carbs, you know, of course, you know, raise your glucose, raise your insulin, and that's just a vicious cycle. So, you know, you have to really watch the carbs.
Okay. Thanks for that, Bernadette. Thank you for sharing your story. I have a kind of tangential question in that one of the things that we've seen recently, and I certainly don't want to fat shame anybody or anything like that, but there's kind of a body positive movement, especially on social media and with a bunch of celebrities saying, hey, this is great to be very overweight, and they show their bodies and they're not embarrassed. And I'm wondering, does that play into it? Because, I mean, you know, it was really more acceptable to be thin, or the standard was that you had to be thin. Do you think that is having any impact on the numbers and the way people regard being obese? Dr. Razak?
My feeling is, Libby, I have noticed this as well. My feeling is that this is not a factor, and I'll tell you why. The dramatic rise in obesity and overweight levels has occurred, as you said, over the last kind of 30 to 40 years. And what we've really seen is that it has the very, very rapid rise happened kind of in about a 10 to 20 year period is when it happened. And what the rates are still rising now, but they're rising much slower because, you know, truthfully, we've already hit more than 50% of the population. And this body positivity movement, which is very controversial, I'll say, I think there's a lot to be said that to criticize the ideal norms of beauty as being, you know, really almost anorexic thin for many years, and unattainable kind of body weight that influenced many, many people really negatively. You had a lot of eating disorders among young women, for example. But this idea of embracing overweight obesity as your natural body is really something that has risen in the last couple of years. And the rise in the overweight and obesity levels definitely occurred much earlier than that. The point that I'll make about the final thing about body positivity is I definitely embrace a lot of the ideas behind body positivity. What I will say is that the evidence for the harms of being overweight and obese are so clear in terms of your health that we should look at ideals of body that do not compromise your health. So I'm not criticizing the idea of body positivity. I'm just saying that the evidence that overweight and obesity is harmful is crystal clear. This is not something that is, you know, an unknown area of science at this point.
Yeah. Switching gears now to measles, there's been a lot of publicity about the few cases of measles that are here, a lot of worry about it. Is that warranted, Dr. Naiman?
Yes, I think it is. You know, in the last 2 weeks, I've had phone calls from patients wanting to know about whether or not they need a vaccine. Do they need to worry? And it reminds me of what happened with COVID, and when people would call and say, "Should I?" And asking questions all the time about COVID vaccinations. So, and I'm just like, oh, well, here we go again. It's another example of we're talking about an illness that when I was in medical school, it was talked about that this would be something you would never see in your life. And now we're having a conversation and having to decide whether I need to vaccinate people. And it really is, you know, it's a little bit complicated and complex in that people who were born before 1970 are considered to have natural immunity, but it would be helpful if they have some idea of remembering them having measles when they were young. And then there's this cohort of people between 1970 and I think in the early 90s when there was only one vaccine, and then the people who were post that to make sure that there's two. And then there's this whole other issue about people who don't vaccinate their children. So it's quite remarkable that we're having these conversations, but there was that case in York Region of the man in his 30s, a teacher who was vaccinated, had two vaccines with no travel exposure and had a case of measles. And I think everybody does need to take account and try to remember what their vaccination story is. And most people can't remember and don't have that yellow card from when they were young. And it's going to be a little bit more complicated, and people are traveling and your risk of exposure increases with travel, especially to destinations where there's measles, like in Europe. And it's just another layer of complexity that I can't believe we're at talking about now, when this is something, you know, that if we had very high rates of vaccination within the population, within our local communities, that we wouldn't be needing to have this conversation at all.
Yeah, well, some people say that the problem was COVID that kept a lot of people from getting vaccinated. It wasn't just the anti-vaxxers or vaccine hesitant people. But Dr. Moore, do you think that there's a danger of an actual outbreak, or are you calling what we have now an outbreak?
Well, I think Fa's more of an expert on these population health things. But, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that what's happening here is that the measles vaccine is highly effective and should be given to children. There's two actually vaccinations. I think it's at 1 year and 5 years. And as the vaccination rates drop, because people choose not to get their children vaccinated, then ultimately you get down to a level of vaccination where there's enough people at risk in the population that the disease can be transmitted between people who are not immune. Like all of us who've had measles vaccines are essentially immune. And I don't know what the number depends on how contagious the disease is, but I think once you get below 80% of the population vaccinated, then there are risks of outbreak. And I mean, I'm not an expert on measles, but my understanding is if you're an adult and you get measles, you can get really sick. Like, it's no joke.
Yeah, you might even die.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, it again raises the issue of making sure that our children are properly vaccinated according to the recommended schedule, because the vaccine itself is highly effective.
Yeah, and I'm certainly old enough to remember a time when your mother took you to spend time with people who had the measles so you'd get it and get over it.
Isn't it wonderful we don't have to do
that?
Right.
Okay. I remember having measles.
I remember having it, too. I might be getting mixed up with chickenpox. I had that, too. But again, Dr. Razak, do you see what we're experiencing now as an outbreak, or is there a danger that this will become more widespread?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And look, this is devastating to see this. Let me describe what the worst case example could be. So Europe is preceding us in terms of these cases rising. In 2022, they had less than 1,000 cases across the European Union countries, less than 1,000. And this year it was 42,000. It went up by 40-fold in 1 year.
Oh my goodness.
This is the most infectious, I would say, to my knowledge, this is the most infectious virus that we know of in medicine. By some estimates, if you're unvaccinated and you're exposed, 90% of people will become infected. It can hang around in rooms. It's airborne. It can hang around in rooms so that if someone was infected and they left the room a couple of hours ago, you come into that room, you can still get infected by the particles that are left in the air. And, you know, to me, this is a reflection of the enormous damage of misinformation and the health system disruptions that occurred during the pandemic. So it's a combined effect of people missing their vaccinations because of the disruption of the pandemic. But misinformation is a significant component of what's happened here. You need 95% plus vaccination rates in order to break transmission in society. We are well below that right now. We also don't have an effective way in Canada in tracking the number of people who are vaccinated. This is an enormous data problem for us. And I think, you know, you heard this from Malcolm, you heard this from Melissa. For us in the medical profession, I think we really need to tell the public this is a disease that can cause permanent brain damage, hearing loss, vision loss, death. And it's something that is preventable. And, you know, a lot of people today who are not vaccinating their children did not live in the era where this was common. I say as a personal story, just using a parallel example, my dad had smallpox. And at that time, you know, 20 to 30% of kids, he had it as a young child, 20 to 30% of kids who had smallpox died. And all parents could do was put them into an isolated room with a caregiver who had survived smallpox and had immunity to it and hope for the best. And a lot of people lost children. And we live in a society now where for the vast majority of these illnesses, you no longer have to worry about losing children, about them developing permanent disabilities. But the rise of misinformation has meant that people have now either ignored or don't believe in the value of the protections or believe in harm from immunizations. And, you know, we've really slid. And it's not just a Canadian problem. It's a global problem. And, it, you know, one of the things that's striking to me is I have very high income, very high, highly educated parents who come in who are against vaccinations, just like I have low income, lower educated parents. It seems to affect people across the board, this idea that vaccines are somehow a conspiracy. And we're talking about our kids. This is serious, long, lifelong effects if they get infected and they're one of the unlucky few.
We have only about a minute left. So I mentioned this parrot fever. If we could just have a quick, is this something we have to worry about now too? It's psittacosis.
This is a rare illness. I'll defer to Malcolm and Alyssa if they've seen one.
Malcolm?
No, I mean, this is something like, first of all, if you don't have a parrot, then you're less likely to get it. But the number of cases is quite low. you know, you get it, and this has been known for a long, long time. I mean, there have been some of these recent outbreaks in Europe, but in that case, outbreak is like 30 cases. So if you have a bird and the bird's sick, do you need to be careful? Absolutely. But otherwise, there are much bigger other things to worry about.
Okay. I think we've worried enough today. So on that note, I am going to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Malcolm Moore, Alyssa Naiman, and Fahad Razak. Thanks a lot. We'll talk again soon.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, are you even aware of the coat of arms for Toronto? Well, it has been quietly removed. We're going to talk about why the historic, or I guess pre-amalgamation, coat of arms has been quietly removed when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Today is Toronto's 190th birthday. The city was founded on March the 6th, 1834, and at the outset, it comprised about 10 blocks around what is now the St. Lawrence Market area. But out with the old and in with the new. We have just learned that the city's coat of arms has been quietly removed. Now, a statement from the city spokesperson said the, quote, former symbols of the city were removed, quote, to ensure compliance with the City of Toronto Corporate Identity Program. And apparently this, the removal, aligns with the city's commitment to truth, justice, and reconciliation, and a city ban on Indigenous-themed imagery. So the old image featured a shield flanked by two human figures, and the one on the left was an Indigenous man. Now, the new one, which we haven't, hasn't been deployed yet, will have a beaver on one side and a bear on the other. Now, I get the beaver, but a bear in Toronto, you know, maybe a raccoon would have been more appropriate. So what do you think about quietly removing the coat of arms of Toronto? The numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And I am now joined by Councillor Stephen Holliday, Ward 2 Etobicoke Centre and Deputy Mayor for the West Area, and Dr. Patrice Dutille, Professor in the Department of Politics and Public Administration at Toronto Metropolitan University. Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. And a good afternoon.
Thank you. Let's begin with Councillor Holliday. How did you find out that this was happening, and what do you make of it?
Sure. There's a few layers to the story, and it actually started out here in Etobicoke, where there's a number of instances of the former City of Etobicoke coat of arms that was designed in 1977 and has hung in the Etobicoke Civic Center since then, more than 40 years. And there was a move that was done within the public service to take those symbols off the wall. And it raised a lot of questions. You know, why is this happening now? And from what I've learned is that there had been some complaints made. We don't have a lot of details on them, but there were complaints. So there was a choice made. And I raised some questions about this. There was a report brought to council, and the executive subcommittee of council chose to take no action on it. Since that occurred, and that's unfolded over the last number of months, there have been other stories about the City of Toronto's old coat of arms, so the pre-amalgamation City of Toronto's coat of arms, that looked rather similar to Etobicoke's, also quietly disappearing from different locations. I will note, the symbols are all over the place, including on the mayor's chain of office, where you would find many of the coats of arms from the pre-amalgamation City of Toronto on that chain linking together into one, and then you have the current coat of arms. And, I think a lot of people have questioned it because we may be one big mega city, but there's lots of politics in that statement, and there's a lot of the idea that we continue to be a city of neighborhoods where people have a unique history, a unique identity. And let's say you ask somebody where they're from, if they're from the West End, often they'll say they're from Etobicoke, not West Toronto. And so that identity continues to exist in our city. And I think a few people are a little concerned that our history is slipping away.
I mean, my question is any time you depict an Indigenous person, is that considered derogatory? Doesn't one of them have Étienne Brûlé, who was a hero?
Well, I think there's a lot of discussion around that, and there's quite a bit of research into it, including me personally taking a trip to the city's archives to look at some of the original artifacts that were used in the creation of the coat of arms. And, some people have wrapped a story around it to say that it was racist and so on, but, one has to wonder if the old city of Etobicoke, whose very name comes from the Ojibwe language, was recognizing the Indigenous history way back in the 70s to put a very prominent figure on the left side of the coat of arms, an Indigenous person, and Étienne Brûlé, which is pre-colonial. So this is early explorers around the time of Champlain in the 1600s, and putting that as also a piece of history on the coat of arms, just to say how deep and how rich the history is. But, fast forward to 2024, and people have their own stories about that, and some people are of the opinion that the imagery is racist.
Patrice Dutille, is this political correctness gone amok?
No, I don't think it's gone amok, Libby. I'm going to take a very different angle on this one. I've seen that coat of arms, and it is offensive. On the left-hand side, you have a bare-chested Indigenous man with some headdress. It's a trope. It never looked like that. And on the right-hand side, you've got this European with a beaver felt hat that's supposed to be Étienne Brûlé. And under the two individuals, you have tradition on the left side, and then you have progress, namely Étienne Brûlé being progress. I'm sorry. This is not an adequate emblem. I don't think Etobicoke needs to have a coat of arms. Toronto needs to have a coat of arms. And certainly Etobicoke doesn't need a coat of arms with a bear on it. I agree with you. It should be a raccoon and a squirrel. But I don't even think they should have. I don't think Etobicoke needs a coat of arms. What this shows, though, Libby, from my mind, what this shows again, and once again, we've been through this with the Dundas, is that we have city staff working in secret. We have the politicians being kept in the dark. We have a process that is broken. The City of Toronto, with a $15 billion budget, conducts its commemoration policy as if it was a popsicle stand. Every time this comes up, it's divisive, it's silly, And it needs to change. City Council really has to take the bull by the horns and adopt a process and adopt a structure to come up with proper decisions on how it commemorates. And it's simply not doing it. And we're basically sleepwalking from one, you know, from one divisive debate to another. And it's got to stop.
Stephen Holliday, is it that City Council is sleepwalking or that all these decisions are made by a left-wing group that's close to the mayor?
Well, there, many people will have different thoughts, including what you just quoted, but there is an important point in this, in that a decision was made to take the coats of arms down by the public service, and there was no discussion around it. And I prompted a discussion by bringing a council motion forward. The motion didn't go where I had hoped or thought it would go. It was simply received by the committee, which meant that they allowed the public service to continue to do this. The public, you know, had very, very little opportunity to weigh in on that. I guess they could have made a deputation at the time, but council took no action. With respect to Professor DeTille's comments, look, I agree with the latter. You know, a lot of this stuff has unfolded in a way that doesn't feel organized or fully put together. There is one thing I wanted to dispute, though, was about the scroll, which is on the bottom of the Etobicoke coat of arms. I'd heard the story before about, you know, there was concern over tradition and progress relating to the bearers of the coat of arms above. But in my research, I actually found sketches of the coat of arms that didn't have the words. So it showed that the imagery was actually developed independent of the words. All of this is buried in the archives, and very few of the public have actually seen this. And that's what worried me, is we didn't have a full examination of the story. And further, if you went into heraldry and you looked at examples of other coats of arms, you would see that often the scroll on the bottom actually completely doesn't have anything to do with the images. So the story comes out on this, and I understand people put it together and they add it together and they feel feelings are feelings, but we never had a chance to talk about this level of detail that I'm doing on the radio, and perhaps it's not even a fair environment to go through all of it. But these are important things to talk about in the city of Toronto, and that's right, it has whisked through, and we found out there's even more things now being taken off the wall and put away, and you know, the full understanding of why is not out there.
And do you agree with Professor DeTille's analysis that basically city staff are running the show and ignoring our elected officials?
Well, I just wonder if the elected officials have granted a very large breadth of authority, and then very sensitive decisions get made, and then people like me are asking questions. How did this happen? Why? And it doesn't promote confidence in government. And that's the bottom line. People see the decision. They may agree with it. They may not. They may agree or may disagree that the image of the Indigenous person was offensive. But the point was, it was done before anyone had a chance to talk about it.
Hmm. Yeah, that and a bunch of other things. And Patrice DeTille, do you think that staff, for instance, got more power and during the pandemic, or did something different happen during then? What was the role of the pandemic in this?
Well, in terms of commemoration, there's no doubt, and it, you know, Councillor Holliday's point is well taken, that the City Council has allowed staff to run away with this issue for a whole variety of reasons, not the least probably because they're so busy that they don't have time to focus on issues around commemoration. But over the pandemic, there's no doubt that city staff basically ran roughshod over the issue of Dundas. They misrepresented the Dundas inheritance, the legacy of Dundas. They have lied about it. The staff, I think, and I'm not holding back on my language, the staff has really misconstrued the issue and led us down a very divisive path. Then we, you know, and then on top of that, we have, you know, the renaming of Young Dundas, which would have a fabulous opportunity to find some sort of uniting symbol. Instead, we wind up with a Ghanaian concept that has absolutely no roots in our society. But anyway, yeah, I agree with you with your saying, Libby. I think that over the pandemic, I think city staff has run roughshod. I mean, there's also the issue around Fort York. There's a whole bunch of issues around commemoration. We adopted a commemoration framework in the city of Toronto that is completely unrepresentative of the, and that dismisses the broad majority of Torontonians, that basically gives veto power to a few small groups. This has passed without commentary from city council. It's a real mess, and it's about time that the city of Toronto adopt a grown-up program for its commemoration so that it can do justice to all those groups that do need representation, that do need to find a visibility in the public square, on the streetscape. We do need to be fair. Let's do it right. Let's do policy correctly instead of just improvising at every turn.
Stephen Holliday, last 20 seconds to you. What would you like to leave us with?
Well, I would really hope that council will adopt a really deliberate policy that recognizes when something has to change and when things are best left alone. And the Dundas debate is a great example where you've got academia on both sides. And this is where we've got a council that has set the bar where there's complete uncertainty on what the history is, and yet they push forward to rename. The big question is what is next and how many things are next and how much is going to change based on a whim? And that's what I think taxpayers need to worry about in the city.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Councillor Stephen Holliday and Dr. Patrice Dutille. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We are going to take another break, and when we come back, we will talk about Super Tuesday yesterday in the States when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Last night was Super Tuesday south of the border, and there were no surprises in those results. Both Donald Trump and Joe Biden won big, setting up the rematch between them in the fall election. But this morning, there was an unexpected development. Trump's last challenger, Nikki Haley, did what she had vowed not to do. She dropped out of the race. What do you think? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Dr. Chris Cooper, political science professor at Western Carolina University, and Brad Palumbo, a conservative commentator and editor-in-chief and co-founder of Based Politics. Thank you very much for joining us, guys. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so let us begin with Dr. Cooper. So all along, Nikki Haley kept saying she's not dropping out of the race, and all the commentary was she's hanging around in case something happens to Donald Trump, she will be there. So what do you think changed her mind?
You know, my guess is a couple of things, and the most important one was green and comes in large piles, and that's money. The Koch brothers, who have funded a lot of her campaign, have poured a lot of money into her campaign, decided that they were out. They pulled out and said they were done. And so I think if you lose your biggest funder, pretty hard to keep going. So I think that's the most important reason. It's also possible that she realized that she doesn't have to stay in the race to be the other alternative. So if we play this universe that's unlikely to happen, let's just pretend for a second Trump ultimately pulls out before the convention for legal reasons or medical reasons. She can still get those votes at the convention just the same if she stayed in or didn't stay in. The only difference is she's not hemorrhaging money anymore.
How would that happen, that she gets the votes, like an old-fashioned convention?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think this is incredibly unlikely. So what we're going to talk about now is almost certainly not going to happen. But let's pretend for a second Donald Trump ends up in jail, for example, and says, okay, I'm not going to run for office from jail. You would then perhaps have a contested convention where different people could make their case. You might see Chris Christie back in there. You'd certainly see Ron DeSantis back in there, and you'd see Nikki Haley back in there. And they would all say, they'd make the case for themselves, and they'd say, give us your votes, delegates. And I think Nikki Haley's case even now would be, I stayed in the longest, I fought the hardest, I have the most votes, delegates of anybody. DeSantis clearly would make a different case, and they would duke it out. I think Haley would be unlikely to win, but hey, we're talking about an unlikely scenario.
Brad Palumbo, according to a poll of most Republicans, they don't care if Donald Trump is convicted criminally.
No, they don't. And I think the more likely scenario, if Trump does go to jail, unless it will, it would depend on the charge, because some of the charges would disqualify him from office, but some would not. I could actually see a scenario, as crazy as it sounds, where he runs from president from jail, wins, and then pardons himself. And of course, that would all be subject to a lot of legal scrutiny and judicial testing, and I don't know how that would work out. But you really can't say, with how American politics has gone over the last decade, that anything is impossible at this point.
I know. It's quite the show to watch. It's really disconcerting, I have to say. Donald Trump, in his speech, I mean, it sounded like the country was completely falling apart. And on the other side, Joe Biden is saying, well, Trump is going to end democracy. He's going to change that. So, Dr. Cooper, what do you make of those two? There's nothing positive in any of it.
No. I think we need to consider the source and consider their incentives in both cases, right? I mean, they're both running fear-based campaigns in different ways. You know, Donald Trump is saying, look how terrible it is now. And Joe Biden is saying, look how terrible it could be. The sad reality is that tends to work, right? Fear does sell. Fear does get people to get off the couch, show up, and vote. Fear mobilizes voters, not just in America, but everywhere. And so, yeah, I think that none of those scenarios resembles the America that I see right now sitting in front of me as I talk to you from Asheville, North Carolina. But clearly it's the vision of America, either prospectively or retrospectively, that both candidates are trying to get people to buy into.
Mm-hmm. Do the American people need a more positive vision in order to get out the vote, Brad?
Go ahead, Brad.
Yeah. I think they get what they ask for. You know, honestly, we have this extremely fear-based media coverage and political campaigning because it's what people respond to. It's what they reward with their clicks, with their views, with their donations, with their votes. Unfortunately, our primary processes here, where they select the party nominations, only a tiny fraction of each party participates in those primaries. And those tend to be people who are extremely emotionally charged or feel very strongly. And so you have this very unrepresentative subsample of each party selecting the nominee. But the only reason that's the case is because of the general public's apathy. If they actually showed up and voted in primaries in greater amounts, they would have different choices. So what you see a lot with Americans is this frustration at the options. A lot of people don't want the choice of Joe Biden or Donald Trump again. They're not satisfied with either option. However, those same people did not participate in the primary process for either side, many of them. So I don't know what the disconnect is here between participating in the system and then complaining about its results. But we have a big one.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm going to take a call from Bob in Burlington. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Two things about Nikki Haley. She's the only politician that has ever paid a visit to Canada to thank Canada for their support and looking after the Americans during 9/11, all the planes that were grounded. And the second thing is, her husband's a veteran. She also paid a visit to a memorial site in Gander for a plane crash back in 1985. She actually wept at the site. Now, that says something about her character.
Yep. Thanks for that call, Bob. Well, people here are very concerned about the possibility of a Trump victory in terms of trade and just about everything else. But I think that's not on the mind of most Americans. Do they think at all about the impact on foreign relations? I mean, the most critical thing are the kinds of things that Trump has said about NATO and about, you know, telling Putin to do whatever he wants to anybody who doesn't pay up in NATO. Dr. Cooper?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Democrats, especially the last piece with Putin, I think they are aware and they're fired up. I think, though, for most Americans, foreign policy is not the most important, the second most important, or the third most important, unfortunately, issues that people are using to make decisions. I think when foreign policy comes up in 2024 in America, it tends to be about one of two things, either the situation in Gaza or about the Ukraine. That's really about it. It's almost like the rest of the world sort of doesn't exist. There's a general sense that foreign policy matters, that the president's the commander in chief, but the specifics of trade, no, most Americans are just not clued in.
Brad, we have a number of issues involving Joe Biden. First of all, I mean, I think it's just plain ageism that people are worried about his age and they're not worried about Trump's age, which is very similar. And we also have this backlash about his Middle East policy, certainly from Arab Americans.
Yeah, I think there's two things there. One, I have to disagree with you that it's ageism because people age differently. And I think the reason that even though Joe Biden is not that much older than Donald Trump, the reason that people are more concerned about Biden's age is because while Trump has always been incoherent in his own way, he doesn't look lacking in mental acuity in public with the extreme frequency that Joe Biden does. I think it's an entirely legitimate concern that people have, even Democrats, even people who voted for him in 2020 and who supported him in 2012 and 2016 as vice president, have this concern about his age and his mental fitness. So I really don't think it is an issue of age discrimination.
Chris Cooper, what do you think?
You know, it's hard to say, you know, is it ageism when you're not saying it about one candidate and you are about the other? You know, I don't know. I sort of agree with Brad that it's a legitimate question to ask. Where people should come down on his mental acuity, I'm not sure. I thought Ezra Klein had a piece in the New York Times that made a lot of Democrats really mad. But what he essentially argued was, hey, like it or not, this is a perception. American politics is about perception. Winning campaigns and elections is about perception. And as long as the perception is that he's not with it anymore, then perhaps the Democrats should think about other options. Now, the last piece, look, it isn't realistic. Joe Biden's not going to step down. The Democrats are not going to take other options. But I do think the Democrats need to be aware that this is a real perception that people have. And Joe Biden does have a habit of not paying attention to the media in the same way that other presidents have recently. He gives fewer interviews. He has fewer press conferences. Even when he's given softball interviews, he tends to not take them. So if the Democrats want to fight back, if Joe Biden wants to fight back, he needs to do it in front of the camera. He needs to show people why they're wrong.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. We're going to wrap things up, but I am sure that we will be talking about this as our friends south of the border will be for a long time to come. Thank you so much, Dr. Chris Cooper and Brad Palumbo. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Bye. That's all the time we have for today. Marissa Lennox will be here tomorrow. I will be back for Free for All Friday. And that's, of course, is the day we'll talk about what you want to talk about. That's all the time we have for now.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.